Yeah, if I say anything bad about Lee Hsien Loong, you'll just edit it out.
Yeah, I...
Like the fact that...
Welcome to the show. Today I have Linus Chen with me. He's not a debater, but his understanding of climate issues is stellar. And I thought that given that climate change-related policies are quite trendy today in debate motions, he will be a good fit for this podcast. So we discuss the obstacles facing climate change activism and what policies are feasible and realistic and can be implemented when it comes to saving the environment. After that, David and I speak about round 3 of Oldham Cup. So stick around for that. Linus, normally this is the point where I'll ask you what your debating license is, but I suspect that your answer will be quite interesting.
Okay, listen to this. I won the RJ Interhouse debate competition in the year 2016, debating something about women being in NS. And it had nothing to do with the fact that it was a British parliamentary style debate. And my partner was the chairman of Raffles Debates
in year four.
It had nothing to do with that.
Let me get this straight.
It was all me.
Let me get this straight. They ran a BP's format.
Yes.
So a BB's format is 4 teams debating.
Yes, yeah.
Right? I went there 5 houses in RJ.
I do not know how they
like which one house just like draw rocks and then could not debate.
I don't know. It was not my problem. My problem was to go in there and win, which I did. So, and they were all the same color to me, you know, the color of defeat, as it were.
Wait, you said your teammate was the chairperson of Raffles Debaters?
Yeah. His name rhymes with Jonathan Jupp, yes.
Right, okay. You could have also mentioned that he eventually went on to win an international championship, so...
Oh, but that doesn't have any relevance to what we're discussing right now, which is my experience.
Okay.
And my expertise.
Right. So you carried Hadley Hallett to single-handedly...
It was about 50-50, give or take 30% of the effort, yeah.
I guess that's something. So what are you here to discuss today, Linus?
We're here to discuss the impending Marxist revolution. I mean climate change. We're talking about climate change.
Are the two interlinked, a Marxist revolution and climate change?
Essentially, the position that is held by Marxists is that essentially because of capitalism's kind of demand for endless compound growth, right? It's kind of like a never-ending spiral of capital accumulation.
Right.
Which if you were a capitalist, which you probably are, you would probably say that that's a good thing because the standard of living of people will continue increasing indefinitely.
Why do you assume that I'm a capitalist?
You just have the capitalist face.
Right, I have the capitalist face, I have the capitalist voice.
Vibe. Yeah, anyway, endless capitalist accumulation. Basically, especially because the economy nowadays is so debt-fueled, right? We constantly need to be producing more and more. And obviously, when we are producing more and more in the form of, let's say, goods and services, we are constantly taking more and more away from nature at the same time. It is possible to produce environmentally sustainable goods, but it's not likely because that doesn't allow for profit maximization.
So, what is the discussion question that you have selected for us today?
Okay, the main thing we are talking about today are like, what are the realistic pathways forward to mitigate climate change? Who are the stakeholders involved? And what do their vested interests tell us about the way that they need to be cooperating or how one party needs to exert its power over another party in order to meet the demands of mitigating climate change?
So I think that there is an implicit assumption that the people that are to be blamed for something should be the people who act on something. If you blame governments for climate change, then governments mm-hmm. should be the ones that act.
Okay, personally, I don't like the thinking about it in the sense of whose responsibility it should be. The question to me should be more of who has the power to tackle this problem in the most effective manner. So you might blame, let's say, a natural gas power plant company for polluting the environment. But I mean, the natural gas power plant still has a role to play in the economy, which is to provide electricity for the people, right?
Right.
If you don't present an alternative form of energy production, you can't just get the fossil fuel companies to stop burning fossil fuels and stop making electricity.
But that's the sort of paradox with regards to like sustainable growth, right? Right. In order to make something so cheap that it becomes the best option for a company, right? You're gonna need to put it through R&D. You're gonna need to put it through lots and lots of like economies of scale. But
yes,
that
yes,
never
yes.
happens if companies don't adopt it in the first place.
Well, I think this is where we need to look at climate change as a problem that needs to be tackled by more than one stakeholder at a time.
Right.
Like, we see what's happening in China right now. China is actually one of the leading countries in terms of R&D into things like solar panels and whatever. But we don't see that as having reached a widespread adoption within China itself, mainly because of this idea of catch-up growth, right?
What does that mean?
Where catch-up growth essentially is this idea that countries like China and India use to justify their massive greenhouse gas emissions. It's linked to the idea of climate justice. And the idea is essentially that countries like UK or the US have had hundreds of years to pollute the environment, like to their heart's content, in order to achieve economic growth. So for China and India to essentially use the same methods like coal and oil burning, like right now, in order to achieve a certain level of economic growth that is necessary for further advancements in technology and standard of living to come later, is something that is ethically justifiable.
Do you think that is something that makes sense to you?
I think it's justified from the perspective of China or the India to say that this is some sort of like economic competitiveness, it's some sort of protectionism. You don't want me to be as rich and powerful as you, therefore you are limiting my emissions. In countries like the UK and the US, they still do rely heavily on fossil fuel generation, but they are moving towards more renewable energy. Obviously, this has gone a bit backwards because of the election of Donald Trump, but over a longer period of time, that has been the trend. So what these countries now are essentially saying is, look, climate change is a global problem. We are doing our part in terms of renewable energy. Why aren't countries like China and India doing their part as well? But what these arguments fail to see is that over the years, over so many years, these are the same strategies that have been employed by the US and the UK in the past. And the reason why China and India have had this so-called sudden explosion of pollution is because in the previous years, because of maybe things like colonialism in the case of India, they were in a stage of backwards development where they couldn't even drive their industries forward because they didn't have the economic ability to do so.
But Linus, it might be unfair, but if it's what is necessary to save the environment in general,
We are looking at two main concepts here, okay? One of them, are you familiar with Garrett Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons?
Yeah, yeah.
What we're looking at here is a situation where we can think of the air quality in general as an environmental commons or something that is shared by the entire world. Because even though there are local variations in the level of air pollution, ultimately global warming is a global problem. Wherever greenhouse gases are released, it's going to result in an increase in global temperature, sea level rise, whatever. So any pollution performed by any actor, any person, or any company is going to lead to negative effects for the entire world. But the benefit of doing that pollution, for example, so that you can generate electricity, which you can sell, is a benefit that accrues to the individual company or country that is the cause of that pollution. it's a cost that is borne by the entire world, but it's a benefit that only accrues to one specific company or country. The second thing I was going to bring up is the idea of the prisoner's dilemma, which is the sense that even though you do have international agreements, be it the Paris Accords or whatever, you see that certain countries don't subscribe to the same level of commitments as other countries. You see that the UN doesn't have any legislative bite to actually enforce the kind of suggestions, I would say, that are put forward in the Paris Accords. So a country like China actually doesn't have any guarantee that just because the US says they're going to pollute less, they are actually going to pollute less. In fact, this is exactly what happened when Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Accords. It is ultimately a global problem, but actors in the real world do not think from a global perspective. They are always thinking of themselves, and if I were to give like a very, like give the benefit of the doubt to their countries, they are thinking of how to make the lives of their own people better, even if it's at the expense of like everybody in the world. The individual cost that they bear is much smaller compared to the benefit that they accrue from conducting this pollution.
So it seems to me like the, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the responsibility lies in individual people holding governments accountable.
You kind of can't really rely on individual citizens to kind of demand for their countries to pollute less, because even on an individual level, like the interests of an individual citizen differ greatly. And there is definitely, like, if you look at America, for example, what's happening with the coal industry, like the coal industry is kind of lobbying to kind of keep coal power plants open, keep coal mines open, even though they are very pollutive, because the interest of these individual citizens or companies that are involved in coal mining is obviously to keep the coal industry as thriving as possible, which is obviously contrasted with like a vegetarian or an environmentalist.
But what I'm trying to say is, like, what the people want matter, and what the people want is what is going to determine what the government is going to be, right? Or at least, okay, I know this is a simplification, but at least to some degree this is true, right? So isn't the fact that people are short-termist an issue, right? That they cannot see the fact that they might end up living in a much worse world in 30, 40 years' time if they don't do something today? And wouldn't that psychological barrier be one of the key obstacles, right, facing climate change activism today?
Well, I can agree with that to a certain extent. I think we are still living in a world where the needs and kind of the desires of the so-called common people, if such a word can be used, are ultimately dominated by things like greater corporate interests. If the coal industry is thriving because of things like lobbying, then the coal industry is going to be the one providing the jobs to the people on the ground. The people on the ground are ultimately dependent on the companies for the jobs that they have to protect their livelihoods. So,
and that applies to like Amazon, you know, and all the other big, you know, hirers in the world as well, lah.
Yeah. As much as we do want to advocate for a bottom-up approach towards solving the problem of climate change, and I think it is important that advocacy groups try and make their voices heard and kind of extend their reach towards each other within the community. We see a limited amount of success of this in Singapore, in the sense that people are using more reusable bags, people are using reusable straws, that kind of things. I would still like to see more leadership being taken from higher up, especially from figures of government.
How do you ensure that? I can't think of a single instance where a government says, you know what, let's f*** our country over, right, for the greater good.
Okay, this is why I bring in the idea of technological growth, right? As I mentioned earlier, we see that China essentially, even though it is one of the, it is the largest polluter in terms of greenhouse gas emissions right now, it is also investing in things like solar panels. And the reason that they are doing this, I believe, is more of a pragmatic reason as opposed to some kind of environmental kind of agenda, right? Like, they are doing this because they know that if they become the leader in green technology in the future, when fossil fuel reserves start to deplete or become more inefficient than green renewable energy, they will ultimately become the country that reaps the benefits from it. Right?
Right.
So I would not accept the argument that economic growth is inherently incompatible with things like renewable technologies. Because if we look at places like Iceland or Norway, it's all about harnessing the expertise that you have and the geographical advantages that you have. So, for example, Norway is actually making so much electricity from hydropower that they can actually sell some of their excess to other countries for a profit.
Linus, surely you have to accept the idea that the slowing down of the global economy is inherently beneficial to the environment. I'm just thinking like...
Of course.
If the economy lever is pushed up to 100%, where does that leave the environment? And is it even feasible for a government to say the economy lever should not be at 100%?
I do think that certain of the barriers to environmentalism or a shift towards more environmental sources of energy is not purely because of the economy. Because if you look at what happened in Japan after the Fukushima incident in 2011, right? We actually see that Japan kind of shifted away from nuclear energy back towards natural gases because of public hysteria towards the safety of nuclear power plants. And this actually led to a slowdown in the economy in Japan, the transition back to natural gases. And nuclear reactors are indeed becoming safer and less accident prone. But if we don't even have a commitment to research and development on these kind of issues to make the technology better and safer because of concerns like public backlash and public hysteria, which are not really founded on any scientific fact, but are more based on the government trying to appease its voter base, then we are seeing barriers to environmental progress that exist not because of the demands of the economy.
So it's a kind of social aspect to it as well. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it is kind of a social aspect, or more of managing kind of the demands of the population, which are not necessarily due to economic concerns.
So besides like technological solutions, other, you know, realistic pathways do you think exist? What I'm thinking about is a lot of debaters like to propose the idea of a carbon tax or like carbon trading. And that seems to be one of the pet policies that exist in the debate circuit. I'm wondering how, you know, what are the issues behind that and whether that is something that is feasible in the long run.
Okay, personally, I'm quite skeptical of the idea of carbon trading for the simple reason that, yes, you do want to kind of turn environmental pollution from a negative externality into a cost that businesses actually have to factor in to their accounting, right? But the problem with carbon trading schemes is that because it's a market-based approach, right? What usually ends up happening is that the really big companies, right? They just continue polluting as much as they can and they just buy carbon credits because at the end of the day, it's more profitable for them to actually pay for these carbon credits and continue polluting than it is for them to actually slow down their pollution.
But the question here is one of supply, right? So like if the reason why this is the case is because the supply of carbon credits is so much that the price of getting them is low enough for a company to absorb. Mm-hmm. Right, so this seems to be an issue about reducing supply rather than a problem with the system entirely.
The idea of carbon trading, right, is that you tax according to the amount of emissions as opposed to, like, for example, like bigger companies pay more taxes, right? If you like reduce the supply too much, you're gonna have a situation where the government is not able to promote the growth of like smaller enterprises within their country that ultimately do still need to produce pollutions or emissions in order to conduct the economic activity. One thing I am happy to see is greater support for the shift towards electric vehicles.
Wasn't there some controversy a couple of years back when Elon Musk said something like, you know, his electric vehicles are not supported in Singapore?
Oh, okay. That controversy was... Basically, Singapore wasn't very keen on supporting Elon Musk's plans for like a supercharger network.
Right, but that seems like it is incredibly important to encourage, you know, the transition to electric vehicles.
The source of the controversy was because our government felt that Tesla's products, the Model S, the Model 3, the Model X, they are more positioned as luxury goods as opposed to mass market goods. So obviously, a Tesla Model 3, right, which is their base model, it costs about as much as a BMW 3 Series. as opposed to a Toyota Corolla, it's not something that could feasibly be widespread adopted by right. the people of Singapore. Right. And number two was that Singapore's like general approach to city planning is one of a car-light Singapore in the future. That's why we are investing so heavily into public transport. So I believe at the time, they were wanting to kind of discourage like any growth of the car population in Singapore whatsoever.
Right.
Which is why they weren't so keen to Mr. Musk's proposals, as it were.
What do you think about Singapore's recent policies that focus more on climate adaptation than mitigating, you know, the effects to the environment? So I'm thinking about, you know, their $200 billion policy to essentially like bolster their sea defenses.
Obviously, I think the building of seawalls is a good idea because I have no particular interest in drowning.
It's money taken away from actually developing, you know, your so-called technological advancements that will then help, you know, the climate. It's the fact that they're all investing in climate adaptation at the expense of reducing the climate change itself. Is that a concern to you?
I see it as another part of the prisoner's dilemma thing, right? It's more of every country thinking there's no guarantee that other countries are going to stop polluting. So
right.
our first order of the day is to protect ourselves. Is that going to hurt the environment? Well, I don't see it as a one or the other, even though you are right that money that goes into adaptation ultimately is money that could have been put into mitigation. But ultimately, there is this basic responsibility, of course, of countries to provide this kind of protection against like future threats or future harms, especially to vulnerable populations or industries that might be living near the sea. It is kind of a ecocentric versus anthropocentric.
What does that mean?
Whether you are thinking more in terms of protecting the environment or whether you are thinking more in terms of the need of the people
right.
living on the ground. So while it might not be helping the environment per se, it is helping people cope or lessen the impacts of the changes in the environment.
But only people within your own borders. And that's my concern, right? Because reducing climate change itself helps everybody. Adapting to climate change only essentially helps rich countries and the people living within those borders.
Of course. Like the Maldives is screwed, essentially.
Right. And isn't that itself, in and of itself, a concern?
Oh, but it's not something we can do anything about.
What I'm hearing here is that you don't think there is a way for international cooperation to exist when it comes to climate change.
Yeah. I would be quite comfortable saying that as extreme a statement as it sounds
so
like.
So, Paris Agreement.
Okay. One thing I would consider successful, the Kyoto Protocol, when they banned the use of chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, in things like refrigerants, you know, because it was making a hole in the ozone layer. I'll tell you why that was successful. It's because chlorofluorocarbons have been replaced by hydrofluorocarbons, which is a new organic compound which doesn't harm the ozone layer as much.
Right. So there was an alternative available.
Technological evolution. And now hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs, to put it more simply, are being actually focused on internationally because they do contribute to global warming
right.
at the same time, even though they don't burn a hole in the ozone layer as much. So We only see international cooperation working when it's a win-win situation for all the countries involved. In the sense of maybe countries working together to share their research and development and their expertise in technology. That's the kind of international cooperation that I see really having an effect in the long run, rather than like delegates talking about things at the UN, which their own governments might not even end up implementing.
But, I mean, that seems to be a very dire picture that you're painting, right? Because I'm thinking that international problems require some degree of international coordination, at least. And what you're saying is that you don't think that this is something that countries or governments are willing to engage in.
I mean, if you've ever watched Mad Max Fury Road, I think that's the kind of society that's going to exist in 100 years' time. If sea levels rise by 2 to 3 feet by the year 2100, that could lead to 4 million climate refugees.
What are climate refugees?
Basically, people that have lost their homes, yeah, because of changes in the climate. Severe droughts across 40% of the planet. If you thought people were thirsty now, just wait till 2050.
That is unfortunate.
Yeah, I do wonder why I'm not more concerned about this.
But that's what I'm trying to say, right? That like there is a psychological barrier for people. I don't know. Like, okay, if I tell you 10 years from now you're gonna get appendicitis if you don't stop eating chocolate.
Right.
Like, you're gonna eat chocolate. You're gonna be like, it's 10 years from now, it's appendicitis, I can deal with it. You know what I mean? Like, there is a psychological thing with humans that prevents the sort of long term considerations that the environment requires.
I can agree with that.
So beyond carbon trading, there's also like carbon taxing, right?
Yes.
Do you think that's a more effective solution?
Okay, so carbon taxing, right? The idea of it is good. Because carbon taxing, and this is actually something that's been implemented in Singapore, carbon taxing places a tax on the emissions that are being produced as opposed to how much money the company is making. Therefore, companies are actually going to be rewarded financially in a sense if they're able to make their processes more energy efficient or more or less pollutive in general, right?
Right.
And here's the problem. We see that Minister for Environment and Water Resources, Masago Zulkifli, is taking a very tough stance against businesses, right? This is a quote. Because they're going to introduce an initial tax of $5 per ton of emissions for pollutive industries in Singapore, right? Let me give you some statistics that show why these companies are not going to leave the country.
Right.
Okay. So we know that these statistics you cannot get anywhere else. This is all math done by me. The carbon tax is going to be $5 a ton of greenhouse gas emissions, right? Until the year 2023. And it's progressively going to be raised every 5 years. So the end point will probably be about $10 to $20 eventually. So this mainly affects oil refineries, power plants, that kind of sector, energy and chemicals. So the total output of the energy and chemical sector in the year 2015, these are statistics from the Economic Development Board, the total output was $81 billion, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's how much money these companies are making, right?
Yep.
And in the year 2014, so around the same time period, Singapore's total greenhouse gas emissions was 50 million tons.
Right.
Right. 60% comes from industry, so about 30 million tons. So if you take the 30 million tons times the $5 per ton, the total amount of carbon tax that is being paid by industry is $150 million. And this estimate is already considered high because not all greenhouse gas emissions are being taxed.
Mm-hmm.
Only those from the very heavy polluters.
Right.
So if you take $150 million out of the total $81 billion output, this carbon tax that they're paying as a percentage of their total output is only
0.18%.
0.18%. 0.18. It's even if we were to increase it to $20 per ton, the figure is only 0.74%, right?
Right.
Like, if I go to a restaurant and I order a plate of pasta, I'm paying 7% tax on the pasta, right? These guys are paying like 10% of that tax to basically irreversibly damage the environment.
But wouldn't there be a amount that would then be acceptable? Like,
what? Like $50 a ton?
So wouldn't like just increasing the price make a big difference?
But why isn't the government increasing the price? It's because we are making $81 billion a year from this sector.
Right, right.
Yeah, so if we were to lose that investment...
So again, that goes back to the prisoner's dilemma, right? We lose that investment to some other country that can undercut us.
Yeah, carbon taxes don't work.
So it seems like there's two big problems here. Two issues that are interrelated. The first is that there is no feasible way to get international cooperation, right?
Yep.
But the second is that international cooperation seems necessary for a lot of the policies that have been proposed, like carbon taxation, like carbon trading,
Paris
Agreement to work, right? And so it seems like all of the solutions that people have been harboring on for the last, you know, decade just mm-hmm. cannot work because of this underlying lack of coordination and cooperation behind it. Right. And so far it seems like the only solution that we've managed to think about is like technological advancement.
Yeah. Here's another technology which I think has very great promise for protecting the environment. It's actually lab-grown meat.
Right.
Because one of the most pollutive forms of agriculture is actually cattle ranching. Like, cattle ranching is extremely land-intensive. The cow's farts produce methane, and methane is one of the most heat-trapping greenhouse gases. And if we are essentially able to move to like a kind of lab-grown meat-based like food industry, right? Then we can engage in large-scale reforestation of the pastures and things which have essentially replaced forests in places like Brazil or whatever, where cattle ranching is very prominent.
So, like, some of the methods that people have been talking about are stuff like ocean iron fertilization. So, I don't know. Do you think that climate engineering is something worth doing?
You would have to ask the scientists. There is an idea that it's worth investigating what the risk is. Which at the same time, like whether it's this kind of like geoengineering projects or simpler things like nuclear energy, at the end of the day, there still needs to be a commitment on the side of governments to support and invest into the kind of industries that are able to provide these kind of solutions to our problems. So I think even as geoengineering might seem like a very exciting alternative to more conventional approaches like solar energy or nuclear energy or reusable plus renewable recyclable plastics or whatever, ultimately it's going to run into the same kind of problems that these more conventional approaches are currently facing if they don't receive the kind of support and commitment that they need.
I think the core question I want to ask now, right, moving on, is are individual actions actually important?
I would say it depends on what kind of actions. Household or domestic electricity consumption in Singapore actually only accounts for 7% of the total greenhouse gas emissions in Singapore. So, okay, I'm not saying that people should just run their aircon like 24/7 or whatever. Like, obviously, it's important to not waste electricity. Obviously, it's important to, you know, turn off the lights before you leave the room and whatever.
Right, save your parents'
electricity bills.
Like, yeah, exactly.
We know that we are supposed to turn off our lights when we leave the room, right? But if we look at, like, for example, at night, you look at schools or, like, office buildings, their lights are actually on, like, overnight. And I'm not sure why this is the case. I'm assuming it has something to do with security. Like, they don't want it to be easy for people to break in and steal things. But I think there is a lot of electricity wastage that is still going on, and this is something we can see with our own eyes, right? We don't even need to go online and search for statistics for all these things.
I mean, I think NUS's aircons are literally, I don't know about this, but like when I go in, I always go to school very early, like if I go to school at all. So I always get there at like 7 in the morning, and so I'll just take any classroom because they're all empty classrooms at that stage, and always the aircon is basically, the room is basically freezing.
Right.
And I'm not sure whether NUS like leaves their aircons on overnight or whether it's just like a turn on at 6 a.m. thing, but I cannot see why you turn on at 6 a.m. and not 8 a.m. if classes start at 8 a.m. anyway. So I suspect that like they literally
overnight, right? There's no one to enforce these kind of things. Yeah, so these small scale things, like, they matter, it all adds up. I don't like to use the word virtue signaling because I think it has been co-opted by some very unpleasant communities on the internet. But I do think that essentially this is what is going on. KFC wants to win like brownie points with the environmentalists and whatever. And they're all like, oh, look, we don't use like straws anymore. We don't give straws. Suck it up. We are like inconveniencing ourselves as a company for the good of the environment. That's the kind of moralistic message that they want to send out. When, like, I mean, wake up your idea. Everything else is still disposable. Yeah, and I'm not saying, like, oh, give Dion back his straws, you know. What I'm saying is don't stop at straws, you know. Like, okay, moving away from the straws itself, right, which I do agree, right, either you get rid of all your disposables or you just keep the straws, right. Other countries have been able to adapt to a reduction in the use of single-use plastics.
We're about to wrap up the conversation about the environment.
Oh, okay.
But I know that you want to talk about your experience at the climate change
rally. Oh, yes. So earlier you brought up the idea about how, like, whether individual people can do more to demand more of their governments, especially democratic governments, so that essentially will show that there's a demand for change from the ground up, and then hopefully that translates into governmental action, right? Okay, so why doesn't that work? Unfortunately, we had the Singapore Climate Rally last year, for those of you who are not aware.
This was in September.
In September,
year, right?
Yes. About 1,700 people turned up. If you actually...
So what's the number for Pink Dot? Like 10,000, right? So 1/10 of the people.
Let's not get into that. Let's not.
Care about gay rights, care about
Let's not get into that. And it wasn't publicized that well, but we had a lot of speakers come out on stage and give very interesting speeches.
I do actually know that one debater from Hwa Chong JC, I think Alan, was one of the speakers at the rally itself. So that's nice.
Oh no, her speech was very good. No, her speech basically centered on how individual humans shouldn't feel climate guilt in a sense for their lifestyle choices. I would rather you hear it from her than from me. I think it's on YouTube. Here's the thing about, obviously, if you have a political movement, right, you have two aims of the political movement. One is to raise awareness among the general population. The other is to get a response from the government.
Right.
So there were some instances in the speeches made at the rally where the government was actually explicitly called out. One guy, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, but you were very cool. One guy went out and said, the government always tells us to turn our lights off, but when have they ever told Jurong Island to turn their lights off, right?
I mean, as an ST, right, like you... Like, for those of you who do not know, my job in like the army was to guard like camps and bases. And like, you can never turn your lights on at a camp. Like, it's just unrealistic. And Jewel Island is a camp. Like, they are literally guarded by STs.
Okay.
From a 9 SIR.
It's a protected place. It's not a camp.
Right, yeah,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, but the point I'm trying to make is that he actually made a very a direct shot at the government. And the government essentially didn't have to address that shot at all. They just had one of the MPs. I forgot who it was, but he came
Louis
down.
Louis Ng, right?
Oh, Louis Ng, my boy. Yeah, anyway, my boy Louis, he came down in his red polo shirt and he kind of wayanged a bit. I'm sorry, I meant he made an effort to connect with the people on the ground and he appeared on like the News 5 Tonight saying, oh, I'm glad to see that people care about the environment, blah, 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 blah. But he didn't actually address any of the arguments that were being made by the speakers. And right, the reason right. why he didn't have to address those arguments is because nobody heard them.
Nobody heard them as in the media didn't report on them.
The media had kind of short snippets, but like it didn't receive the amount of public attention that it had hoped to. Like. In fact, if you look on supposedly liberal forums like Reddit, a lot of them were quite, I would say, cynical towards the idea of public advocacy in the first place, especially on issues like environmental issues.
So, do you think this is a product of the fact that this is the first time that this has ever happened? Or do you think that this is a recurring trend when it comes to climate activism?
It's certainly not limited to Singapore, this kind of skepticism. Like, if you look around the world, the kind of negative
right, but
comments
I'm thinking
that have been made.
That, you know, in other countries, there are bigger climate movements, you know, like Extinction Rebellion, like, you know, Fridays for Future, whatever the f*** it's called, right?
Hey,
like,
language.
I'm thinking from the Singapore context, is it a deep-seated apathy, or is it just because it's the first time that this has happened?
Okay, there is a problem with advocacy in general in Singapore, right? Which is that it happens in Hong Lim Park. It happens in a contained space. If you were in a taxi going past the Hong Lim Park, you might not even have realized there was a rally happening. And I think there is generally this kind of apathy towards advocacy in general. Because number one, as you said, most people don't think long term. Number two, people in Singapore might not actually believe that ground up political movements actually do anything. Because there's just no robust climate of political discussion from the ground up in this country.
Is there just something about climate change that makes it unappealing as an activist subject? When something that is so... that affects everybody can get so little attention.
Well, it might be. I think maybe being committed to a cause like climate change, right? It requires a lot larger lifestyle choices than simply saying, oh, I support gay marriage. You might have to like take the MRT more instead of driving a car.
Right, because you'll be seen as a hypocrite, right? Like if you don't...
Exactly. That's something that was brought up. Yeah, so... The cynicism might come from this like perception of hypocrisy.
And I mean, that's one way that climate change activists have been attacked by the right-wing media in
Yes.
In other countries, right? So I'm thinking like, you know, when XR, Extinction Rebellion in the UK, goes on, you know, the BBC or goes on like Piers Morgan's program, there's a lot of questions about, hey, So do you throw out your computer? Do you throw out your TV? Oh, why do you still have a TV? Yeah. Like, f*** you, you know, like. And that's the kind of metric that is used against these activists.
Does it matter? Does it matter if like someone who leads a climate change rally sometimes uses a plastic straw when they order Starbucks? You know, like these kind of you know, ad hominem responses, right? They only serve to detract. Like, attacking someone as a hypocrite doesn't mean that environmental issues are not a big problem.
And to address your issue or Starbucks, I dare you to drink a frappuccino without a straw. I do not know how that is even physically possible.
Yeah, assuming that I can afford frappuccino, which I can't because I'm gonna study geography when I grow up.
But yeah, I see your point. Any closing thoughts about, you know, environmentalism?
Maybe one thing I would say is that I didn't intend for this to come out as pessimistic as it did. But that's why I think that environmental education or awareness of environmental issues is something that has to start from young. It's something that has to be emphasized in our schools. Perhaps what I like to see more of is a greater focus on the Singaporean context. As much as we do look at the big picture of climate change in schools, which is a good thing, I would like to see more emphasis on what is being done or what can be done but is not being done in Singapore to a greater extent. Yeah, like things like the Pulau Semakau, like the waste to incineration plant, all that kind of things. It's not something we talk about to a great degree in schools. And but beyond just the content, I would like to see a greater emphasis on building an attitude of compassion and thinking about people whose lives are different from us, whose challenges they face are different from us. Not just in the context of like climate change, but just in general.
So obviously you don't have debate experience, but you have a lot of acquaintances. And I recall that you were in a class a couple of years back that it was essentially like filled to the brim with debaters, right? Or
argumentative little wankers.
What?
I didn't say that. Have you noticed that some debaters, and it is a minority, but it's a minority that is so significant that I have noticed it. Some debaters talk in a fake British accent when they're on stage. And it's really annoying because, like, I know you can talk like a normal person. Like, do y'all give bonus points for having like a fake like Cockney accent when you're on stage or whatever?
I can't recall ever deliberately giving a point for an accent. But I mean, I think this is actually a fairly interesting conversation to have about like language use in debating, because I think one of the big divisive parts of the Singaporean circuit, and I know you don't know this, so I'm telling you now.
Yeah.
Is the idea of style and how much it can be credited. But there's a lot of controversy over whether this unfairly penalizes people who come from backgrounds where you're not going to be able to pull up these fancy big words. You're not going to be able to pull out a fancy British accent. You've spoken half English, half Hokkien all your life.
Yeah.
Because of the environment that you've grown up in.
Mm-hmm.
Will this result in you being penalized even if your argument is clear? Even if a person can follow the words that you are saying, right? And that, and your argument is better than your opponent's or is clearer than your opponent's.
Okay, and, but when you say style, right, what specifically are you marking for?
So that's the thing, right? There is a standard in the WSDC format for what good style is. But the standard has evolved, I will admit, but it is also really, you know, dependent on whether the judge that is judging your round is an old school judge or a new school judge, whether they primarily, you know, judged overseas, whether they primarily judge in the WSCC format or in other debating formats.
Right.
Now, I don't want to go into that. That you won't be able to contribute to that particular discussion.
Yeah.
But what I will say is that, I mean, I think about my schools. I don't just coach elite schools. And so, you know, there are debaters who come in to my CCA and you can tell that they've grown up in an environment where speaking proper English is not a priority. They communicate to their parents in Chinese or in some mixture of, you know, Singlish and dialect, right?
Yeah,
therefore, while they have ideas, and honestly, I can, you know, after a while, you can fully understand those ideas. I mean, there's a chance that they do get penalized for the way that they speak.
Wait, like, do you mean they, like, speak in Singlish when they are debating in a competition?
They don't speak with a... No, they use... Sometimes they use a bit of Singlish, but they just don't speak in you know, your quote-unquote fancy British accent, lah. They speak like the coffee shop uncle who's trying to convince you that Toto is rigged, you know what I mean? The argument is clear to me, right? But that could be just a function of me being very used to hearing these styles in my regular training.
Okay, this is my stand on the issue, right? If you are speaking to an international audience, you have to be able to speak something that closely resembles what we think of as standard English, right, in an international context.
But there's a difference between speaking standard English and having intelligible words, like words that make sense, and your accent.
I think that if these people are being penalized for example, like improper forms of grammar and syntax, that's acceptable. If they are being penalized just because of their accent, then obviously that's wrong. That's not something that should be condoned.
Imagine losing a debate, like even having the better argument than your opponent because you don't have good grammar.
Well, I mean, we're not just looking at the intellectual content of the argument itself, but the clarity of the argument and the way it's presented.
So
right?
that's the controversy with the format, right? Because some people are saying, no, it should really just be about the argument. No, I can see it both ways. I mean, I do emphasize the need for grammar, grammatically correct sentences, and like I try to fix some things about how people speak for the benefit of a wider audience. But I can also see the case that you're really disadvantaging people from backgrounds that aren't as privileged as your RIs or your ACSIs of the world.
But one could also argue that it is necessary for students of within our education system to learn how to speak in a form of English that is context appropriate.
I completely agree. So if you're thinking of things like if you're thinking of debate as a learning experience, right, and you're thinking of debate in terms of like, hey, this is going to help you prepare for interviews, in the future. You need to speak pretty good English in the interview, That's an unfortunate reality of life. And so if you think of debating as a learning, just purely from a learning perspective, then I can totally get why something like syntax, something like your clarity in terms of the accent that you have is important.
Yeah.
But at the same time, nobody goes into a rugby tournament thinking, hey, rugby is meant to teach me this and that, right? Like, it's a competition. A competition requires fair rules.
Right. Well, I mean, I think what we can agree on is that you shouldn't get bonus points for having a fake British accent or saying panacea instead of solution or whatever. I do agree that at no point in time should there be a case where the team with the worst argument ends up winning the debate just because their English sounds better. That's something I can agree with. Yeah, I'm not impressed by your fake British accents. That's all I have to say. You can just cut everything else but that.
Right, so this is a extra section for episode 3 because Linus is not a debater, and we'll be talking about round 3 of Odom Cup.
This house opposes the norm that popular culture aimed at children should have happy endings.
What do happy endings even mean? Like, the good guys win? Like, I don't know.
I think happy endings in general are endings where the protagonists or the protagonists... Happy endings are when the protagonists tend to get what they want at the end of the show. So, for example, in the case of Snow White, she gets her true love's kiss and the Prince Charming like falls in love with her and she lives happily ever after. So, an example of like happy endings in general. I think the main thing that we need to first look at and clarify is what exactly do we mean when we say that something is a cultural norm.
Okay, how about you tell me?
At its core, norms are certain sets of cultural fabrics and schemas. Schemas being a certain type of thought, such as, let's say, okay boomer, or NIMBY, not in my backyard syndrome and all this. A certain kind of cultural DNA or piece that has been propagated virally, or at least prolifically, within a certain culture. So this in turn forms a norm or a sort of value system by which people within that culture uses to define and create meanings in their life. So for example, cultural norms of xenophobia are used to create and define certain political views that individuals may have towards certain policies that a government may implement, such as, let's say, you're an American and you want Trump to build the wall. Why do you want Trump to build the wall? It wasn't because you woke up one day and decided having a wall is cool. It's because society tells you repeatedly through various means, such as on the media or perhaps your family members and all that, that immigrants are bad, right? That Mexicans are stealing your jobs, and therefore we need a wall to keep the Mexicans out of America. So in a similar vein, what popular culture does is it perpetuates many kinds of general cultural norms or stereotypes, if you want to put this in a more like negative connotation. And in this case, popular culture specifically tells children that certain behaviors tend to lead to certain positive outcomes. In this case, if you're a good guy or if you're the protagonist, good things will necessarily happen to you. You'll have a happy ending in life. And that kind of norm, that kind of mindset, in turn transfers to the way the child creates meaning in his or her life and the way they perceive things in society, right? So there's this expectation that if you do something good, there must be some sort of moral desert awaiting you at the end of the day. I mean, like, I think there's an interesting case to be made, right? That society is a very sad case, yes. And that you need a certain degree of hope to exist in order for children to do well. But then the question becomes, do we need pop culture to do this? Or should pop culture, in fact, reinforce what reality is because certain other veins, such as fairy tales or school or civic and moral education, is already doing the part of enforcing the idea that you should work for moral deserts and that therefore a countervailing force is required.
You don't consider fairy tales to be part of pop culture?
They definitely intersect, right? But I think a huge portion of fairy tales don't fall under pop culture. So maybe newer Disney films, for example, do fall under pop culture. But if you look at the old Disney films like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs or like
Pinocchio?
Pinocchio, yeah, like, these things are no longer what people would call popular, right? They're more like occultist or like old school kind of videos. It's like they're out of style. And
right,
I think
right.
There's a significant
right.
portion of
right.
fairy tales that fall under that category.
So is Jimmy Neutron pop culture? Is Phineas and Ferb pop culture?
I think that's a very interesting question. And I don't mean this sarcastically, I mean this like genuinely, right? Because if you asked, let's say a millennial about Jimmy Neutron, they'll probably be like, this is like what old people watch, right? This is old people show. This is not pop culture. But if you ask like a Gen Xer what Jimmy Neutron is, they'll probably tell you that if it's a nostalgic element.
Is it? I thought millennials are the ones who grew up with Jimmy Neutron. It's the
I mean,
we are millennials, but I mean, I watch a lot of
Gen Ys, right? Like, I don't know.
Right, right. But I mean, I thought millennials would be the ones who grew up with Rugrats
I was thinking more like Geronimo
Parents,
Stilton,
Ben 10.
Yeah.
Right. And the Gen Zs, I don't know what they watch nowadays, the latest generation, but I don't think that I have a feeling that it's not Rugrats anymore, so.
Definitely, yeah. And so this is where we run into our first interesting problem with the motion, I think, that needs to be settled, which is that pop culture as a genre, pop culture as a sphere of discourse, is something that is neither well-defined nor definable, even. And how are you going to have a debate on this, right? That's the question. Versus, let's say, fairy tales, where you just go like, you know, Grimm's Brothers, Hans Christian Andersen, there's a clearly defined field for discourse. And I think this ambiguity is itself something that can be weaponized in this motion. Because I think part of pop culture is a sort of contestation between different ideas and different groups of people, right? Like pop culture is where culture wars itself fundamentally occur. It's a battle place for like cultural dominance between many different groups of people, right? Like between boomers who want to make boomer stuff relevant again, and young people who want to watch Netflix all day.
I have a question about the idea of a happy ending. So the discussion about cartoons, right, and Phineas and Ferb, you know, has led me to the realization that if you think about it, neither Phineas nor Ferb are particularly moral creatures.
That's true.
Didn't they over their parents and like over their sister multiple times and aren't they responsible for like a lot of happening?
If you're applying a static moral system, right, which is like a moral system of what society as a whole believes in. I think I'll agree that Phineas and Ferb are pretty immoral people and they don't deserve the happy endings they get, and like reinforcing that is a bad thing, right? But in many cases, in many of these shows, there are relative moral systems within the shows that the characters are conforming to. So for example, let's talk about like The Incredibles, right? Or superhero films in general, where there are a ton of collateral damage, but the hero is somehow doing the right thing because moral relativity. The perspective of the child isn't the perspective of society, right? You're not viewing Phineas and Ferb from the lens of a parent or from the lens of a mature adult. You're viewing it from the lens of a kid who is viewing the show through the lens of Phineas and Ferb. And in the eyes of Phineas and Ferb, what they're doing is conforming to a set of morals or a set of values that are internally consistent or not. We don't know, but generally internally consistent. And maybe that set of values, if believed and taken as the perspective of things, may, in certain senses, reinforce certain positive behaviors, like caring for your friend or standing up for yourself.
Shall we move on to arguments?
Honestly, I can't think of anything particularly creative.
So I guess my advice would be, spend the bulk of your debate framing it and then just give the wits and worst argument.
I think that's honestly the only real strategy throughout this motion. Like, if finesse is a thing, right? Finesse is
It's like, here's 4 minutes about moral relativity and cultural norms and pop culture and what it means.
I think an interesting thing to consider might be how these cartoons are perceived differently by people in different social statuses or socioeconomic classes. So I think there's a theory that like rich children who generally grew up in a more privileged world, who have more access to good things, would tend to perceive cartoons that have happy endings as positive reinforcement, right? Like, it's the idea that these are things that is correct. Whereas if you're a child who comes from an impoverished family, right, and you see films that tell you that, oh, if you do this and you do that, you happen to have a nice pretty car or like have the money to buy lunch for your poor friend, you will be rewarded for it. I think it tends to send a message of despair that you have to do things in order to get good things to happen to you. And by virtue of your lack of privilege, you can't do things, and therefore good things can't happen to you.
Do these pop culture cartoons and stuff, do they even have an impact on kids? Are they even important?
I think there are different ways of looking at the importance of pop culture. I'll just start with the most intuitive one, which is that pop culture is itself a sort of social capital and symbolic currency that can be used and traded between people. For example, if I watch the same kinds of shows as my friends, or same kinds of shows as groups of people, this gives me a sort of activity I can bond over, right? A sort of like thing I can talk about with my friends. So I go to school, because I watch Pokemon religiously, I'm able to talk to my friends about Ash and Pikachu and how Misty is cute and how like Pikachu is cute or how like Brock has really weird eyes. And it forms a part of a person's ability to socialize with people. That's a first level of looking at it. On a second level, I think what pop culture does is that it forms a frame by which you perceive social cultural norms around you. So a child, for example, growing up watching anime would tend to have certain features that defines them behaviorally. So for example, weeaboo culture, right? Like, it forms a sort of social cultural frame by which you perceive people and by which people perceive you. Cartoons and shows and popular culture play into our psychological discourses about how we perceive our self-identity as well. Inform you of certain social practices and behaviors, and humanizes or mystifies certain kinds of behaviors, such as friendship, such as loyalty. So I think something else to look at with regard to pop culture is it's constantly evolving, it's constantly growing, it's constantly subverting itself. And within such a sphere, how functional or how practical is it to have didactic messages such as you have good endings? And is the imposition of such didactic messages on an extremely fluid and extremely mercurial medium necessarily a good idea in terms of sending messages to people? That may be something that you can explain. I think the first thing to start off with is like what the state of the world is. And that largely affects like the kind of arguments that both sides will run. So if the state of the world is good, having positive reinforcement of that goodness might be a good thing, right? And saying that you might have bad endings may contravene what reality is like, where people tend to have good endings, where they tend to be like a bunch of opportunities. So I feel like it's a lot more strategic to like frame the world as one that is more negative, more bad, like for both sides really. And on side proposition, the main argument is the world is bad, right? You need to have this sense of reality check that you give your children. And on side opposition, it's like, the world is bad. Therefore, we need to give children a healthy space to grow up before they have to deal with the reality that they're going to be thrown into. So I feel like that's probably the first starting point that both teams kind of have to agree on. And then the second part that will probably come into contention is the part about how children react. So you probably need to put in some legwork into defining how children will react and how children will respond to films. I think we went through a bunch of mechanisms just now on how films or popular culture affect people. So children specifically are particularly susceptible to social norms, right? Because they don't have a defined self-identity yet. They're in the process of searching for their identity. And the way they do that is through looking at things in the world, such as popular culture, to craft and imitate their identity, right? Because I think children learn through mimesis. They imitate certain behaviors and through the imitation form their identity.
So here's the thing. I think like these are things that both sides can use. I think this is one of those debates where both sides will be saying the exact same thing and then disagreeing about they disagree on literally the smallest thing, right? Because everything else is constant. The idea that popular culture influences people, that's constant. The idea that the world is bad, that's constant. The disagreement is over a very minute space in the discussion, right?
Yeah.
Right. So once you do that correct, that's where my frustration comes in. I cannot think of more than like 3 minutes of useful material that is actually dichotomous between the two teams.
I think there are two potential ways that children can take films that have good endings. The first is that it normalizes the idea that children will become very pragmatic, right? You need to get rewards in order to want to do good things. And that is good because some children aren't going to do good things in the first place, right? They're kind of like assholes. And the converse view is that some children may be willing to do things out of the altruism of their heart. But after normalizing the culture that you should get something in return for doing good things, it disrupts or prevents the growth of altruism within children. Right. So I think there's a sort of like clash or trade-off here between, do we want children to learn to do things for rewards so that they will learn to do things? Or do we want to focus on developing the altruism and the principle-based growth in children first, and which is more important to develop at a young age?
Okay, so here's one interesting angle that I think that Op might be able to take in this debate. If not for the fact that so many shows out there exist where the good person wins, it wouldn't be impactful to the child when the bad person wins.
Yeah, that is true. And I think that's a very interesting argument. As in, that is that you rather have a norm of good people winning and bad people occasionally winning than a norm of bad people winning and good people occasionally winning.
Okay, so I was thinking Tom and Jerry, because I watched a lot of Looney Tunes and I watched a lot of Tom and Jerry back in the day. I distinctly remember that the people who tended to win, like so-called win, were often the people who were not good per se and would actually do very questionable things, but the show painted them as the person to fight for the underdog, right? And that sort of excused their behavior in a way. So I'm thinking like Jerry, right? Like Jerry is an asshole, right? But the show frames him in a way that makes you root for Jerry because he's a little guy, right? You do not want Tom to win. And similarly, Bugs Bunny, right? Like he gets off, right? Basically because he's more cunning than the others. I don't think that he's more morally upright than any other Looney Tunes character, right? I mean, nothing that he does is particularly good, right? Or altruistic, right? It's always self-serving, right? When Bugs Bunny does something, right? But you root for that one character, right? To get a happy ending. Like, is the implicit assumption in fact wrong in the motion? Because I'm thinking that the cartoons that I watched always had self-serving characters that got their way, but I didn't see any sort of good behavior from them. I didn't see any kind of altruistic behavior from these characters.
I think there's a second argument here that potentially can be made, or more of an observation, which is that the protagonist has to win by virtue of being a protagonist, even if they're not good per se.
Right.
And I think this might be a frame that definitely benefits side proposition. But I think there's a reason to be made with regard to why protagonists have to win even if they are not doing good things, I guess. The point of a children's show is to humanize. And the protagonist tends to be the most humanized actor in the movie. And if we normalize the idea that humans deserve to have bad things happen to them, that may perpetuate negative views about how we should treat people humanely, right? Because the idea that is normalized when you say that protagonists should have happy endings is that even if the person isn't perfect, by virtue of them being human, they deserve some sort of privilege, right? Of being treated properly, of getting what they want. Where the converse would be that they don't, right? That humans deserve to be punished in general. Like, there should be a culture of guilt hanging in the air of humanity because we're all, like, evil people.
But is that a good argument for Pop as well? That because there's a kind of moral relativism over time, if there is a prevailing moral norm and TV tends to stick to that moral norm, then progressivism just cannot happen.
I think that's...
Because kids get particular ideas, right, from their childhood.
Yes.
So let's end off with favorite cultural phenomenon from your childhood and why it was so influential.
I think maybe a book. Like, this is one of the popular writers that at least were popular a while ago. Like, is this dude called, like, Kazuo Ishiguro? And he largely inspired me to, like, take up literature as a subject. So the book that kind of acted as a turning point was Remains of the Day. It really opened my eyes to what it meant to have emotions and what empathy is for people, right? Because I think in many cases, schools, like CME lessons, they tell you to care for friends and stuff like that. But I think it's really in this book that I really was able to feel for myself what it means to lose a friend, to like someone, to fall in love with someone, right? And how words as a medium of culture and words as a medium of communication can have so much power and effect on people. It's not just a bunch of black ink on paper. It's something that captures the soul and captures the mind and is able to transform you as a person. And I think that feeling was very empowering. It was the idea that even if, you know, I'm this poor Chinese boy stuck in school learning useless things like mathematics and science, leading a terrible existence, there is a way out of this, right? And the way out of this is within easy grasp. You have to master the way you use words, the way you express yourself, and it's largely all in your mind. And I think, to a certain extent, this democratization of culture, this democratization of books as a whole is something that I see increasingly prevalent in society as well. So I think, like, that's great. I was surprised that I was able to cry over, like, a pile of words, right? But, like, that just goes to show how the emotional impact of even shows where protagonists don't get happy endings can have on people. Wow, this really makes things hard for opposition.
If you're on all the best, lah.